Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. We close the show with our program, American Stories. But first, many car racing teams have rich supporters with ideas that sound too good to be true. Most of the ideas fail before the cars even make it to the track. Jackie Heinricher, however, has had success with her idea. She has formed an all-female team of drivers. The team will take part in an important race this month. It is called the Rolex 24 at Daytona. It is one of the most respected races of its kind in the world. As the name suggests, the race lasts 24 hours, testing the driver and the car to the limit. Heinricher's dream became a reality when the company Caterpillar agreed to be her sponsor. She also partnered with Meyer Shank Racing and signed up top racers. British driver Catherine Legg is one of them. "I am scared a little bit," she said. "I am scared that it will be gimmicky and we won't be taken seriously. That's why we have the drivers we have. That's why we are going with a professional team. That's why we made sure we had everything to do it right." Heinricher is a scientist who formerly served with the United States Air Force. She established a biotech company, Bouchut Technology, based in Sun Valley, Idaho. She is also an independent race car driver who pays to race against professional drivers. Heinricher is a racing fan who often cheered for female drivers. Just like many of them, she was angered by the difficulty they find in moving up in the industry. Heinricher grew tired of seeing such women leave the U.S. for Europe's racing industry. "I started having this vision to bring these top women professionals together to race a season together," Heinricher said. Legg was part of carmaker Lotus's non-competitive return to IndyCar racing. She also was the announced driver for an Indianapolis 500 team that was going to be formed entirely of women. But that never happened. Legg knew about Heinricher's idea for 2 years. She agreed to join because it appeared that the plan would really happen. Legg was already part of Meyer Shank Racing, and her Acura team won twice last season. It finished second overall in its category. Heinricher's team includes Legg, who is the full-time driver of the car. Simona Del Silvestro, known as the Swiss Missile, is another member. Brazilian Bia Figueiredo is the only woman to have won several Indy Lights races. Completing the team is Christina Nielsen from Denmark. She is a 2-time International Sports Association champion. The team has more combined experience and success than Danica Patrick, the most famous female racer of this generation. Catherine Legg said she hopes the team will provide girls with an example to follow in racing. Nielsen said she and Legg like to repeat the saying, "Once you are behind the wheel, the car can't tell if it is a man or woman driving.
Scientists have long attempted to find materials to make batteries that are more powerful but cost less to build. In the United States, researchers are experimenting with sodium to see whether it can power much improved batteries in the future. Sodium is a soft, silvery metal. It is plentiful and found in seawater. The most common battery used today is made of lithium ion. These batteries power everything from smartphones to computers to electric vehicles. Researchers from the University of California, San Diego, are attempting to build a new generation of batteries powered by sodium instead of lithium. The U.S. National Science Foundation is providing financial support for the experiments. Shirley Mung is a member of the research team.
At a society level, I think people really think that a battery is a done deal, like it's an old subject.
But Mung says the process of developing better batteries is still a work in progress. In fact, she says the energy density of batteries in use today can still be doubled or tripled. The California researchers are studying lithium-ion batteries, but in the next few years plan to begin testing new sodium batteries. Team member Haley Hirsch says she looks forward to working more with sodium development in the future.
We want to use sodium instead of lithium because it has different properties, and also sodium is much more abundant.
Lithium is costly and not easy to collect because it is widely spread across many parts of the world. Large amounts of water and energy are also required to gather lithium. But sodium is found in the world's oceans, with a seemingly limitless supply. This would lead to much lower costs to produce sodium ion for batteries. Hirsch says she is examining different ways to make batteries that last longer and can store more power.
Right now it's just in the lab, and we're working on figuring out how to make it hold more energy and last longer so that it can be used in your phone, in your car, or even to store energy for solar, for wind.
Finding better ways to store more energy at a lower price has been one of the major barriers to developing more powerful batteries. I'm Brian Lynn.
Have you ever noticed the number of times that a native English speaker uses the word ever? Ever is an adverb that we Americans say a lot. Here's today's question from Zanoni in Venezuela.
Hello, I would like to get some tips about the right usage of the adverb ever. Thanks in advance.
Hello, Zanoni. There are many ways to use the word ever, but some of them are very formal, less modern, or more common in British English. So it might help more if I tell you how Americans most often use the word. There are a few ways we use it. The first way means at any time. For this meaning, we often use it in question form.
Have you ever visited Zanzibar?
Do you ever wonder how you will look in 10 years?
What is the best film you have ever seen?
Note that the third example uses the superlative adjective best. We can also use ever in statements, such as when you are describing something with a superlative or comparative adjective.
The Ring is the best horror film I've ever seen.
The cost of living is higher than it has ever been.
In negative statements, we can use the term not ever to mean not at any time. But never is much more common. Listen to the following sentences that have the same meaning. He doesn't ever let his mother finish speaking. He never lets his mother finish speaking. But with negative words like nobody, no one, rarely, and hardly, we use ever instead of never. Let's listen.
No one here ever cleans up after themselves.
I rarely ever carry money with me.
Americans also use ever in the expression ever since. It means continually or often from a past time until now, which is similar to the meaning of since. But using ever adds strength to the statement. Listen.
Ever since I started stretching, my back has felt much better.
You can also say it like this, with the same meaning.
My back has felt much better ever since I started stretching.
And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 2.
The man cursed, threw the empty gun on the ground. He uttered a cry of pain as he started to drag himself to his feet. It was a slow task. When he finally stood on his feet, he needed another minute or two to straighten himself so that he could stand as a man should stand. He climbed a small hill and looked about. There were no trees, no bushes. There was nothing but grassy, gray plants and some gray rocks and gray streams. The sky was gray. There was no sun or promise of sun. He had no idea where north was. And he had forgotten how he had come to this spot the night before. But he was not lost. He knew that. Soon he would come to the land of the little sticks. He felt that it lay to the left somewhere, not far. Possibly it was over the next low hill. He returned to prepare his pack for traveling. He assured himself of the existence of his three separate portions of matches, although he did not stop to count them. But he did pause, trying to decide what to do about a bag made from moose skin. It was not large. It could be covered by his two hands. But he knew it weighed 15 pounds, as much as all the rest of the pack. This worried him. He finally set it to one side and proceeded to roll the pack. He paused again to gaze at the moose-skin bag. He picked it up quickly, with a quick glance around him. It was as if he thought the cruel wasteland was trying to steal it. When he rose to his feet, the bag was included in the pack on his back. He started walking to the left, stopping now and again to eat muskeg berries. His ankle had stiffened, but the pain of it was nothing compared with the pain of his stomach. His hunger was so great he could not keep his mind steady on the course he had to follow to arrive at the land of the little sticks. The berries did not help his hunger. Their bitter taste only made his tongue and mouth sore. He came to a valley where some birds rose from the rocky places. "Coo, coo, coo," was the sound of their cry. He threw stones at them, but could not hit them. He placed his pack on the ground and followed them as a cat advances on a bird. The sharp rocks cut through his trousers until his knees left a trail of blood. But the hurt was lost in the pain of his hunger. He moved his body through the wet plants, becoming wet and cold in the process. But he did not notice this, so great was his desire for food. Always the birds rose before him. Their cry of "Kur, kur, kur," sounded as if they were laughing at him. He cursed them and cried aloud at them with their own cry. Once he came upon one that must have been asleep. He did not see it until it flew up in his face from behind some rocks. He grasped the air as suddenly as the rise of the bird, and there remained in his hand 3 tail feathers. As he watched its flight, he hated it. He felt that it had done him some great wrong. Then he returned to where he had left his pack and lifted it again to his back. As the day continued, he came into valleys where game was more plentiful. 20 or more caribou passed by within easy shooting distance of a gun. He felt a wild desire to run after them, certain that he could catch them. A small black animal came toward him carrying a bird in his mouth. The man shouted. It was a fearful cry, but the animal, leaping away in fright, did not drop the bird. Late in the afternoon, he followed a stream which flowed through some thick grass. He grasped these grasses firmly near the root and pulled up what looked like a vegetable. It was round and white. Eagerly, he sank his teeth into it. It was tender on the outside and gave the promise of food. But its inside was hard and stringy, and like the berries, it had no food value. Nevertheless, he threw off his pack and went among the grasses on his hands and knees, eating the grass like a cow. He was very tired and often wished to rest, to lie down and to sleep. But he was led on not so much by his desire to find the land of the little sticks as by his hunger. He looked into every pool of water, searching without success for things to eat. Then, as the night darkened, he discovered a single small fish in one of these pools. He plunged his whole arm in, but the fish escaped his grasp. He reached for it with both hands and stirred the mud at the bottom of the pool. During his excitement, he fell in, getting wet as high as his shoulders. Then the water was too cloudy with mud to allow him to see the fish. He was forced to wait until the mud had again settled to the bottom. Then he tried again, until the water was again filled with mud. But he could not wait. He took a tin container from his pack and began to empty the water from the pool. He threw it out wildly at first, and so short a distance that it flowed into the pool again. He worked more carefully, trying to be calm, but his heart was pounding and his hands were trembling. At the end of a half an hour, the pool was nearly dry. Not a cupful of water remained. And there was no fish. Then he discovered a narrow opening among the stones through which it had escaped into a larger pool, a pool which he could not empty in a night and a day. If he had known of the opening, he could have closed it with a rock before he began, and the fish would have been his. Thus he thought, and he sank down upon the wet earth. At first he cried softly to himself, and then he cried loudly to the uncaring wasteland around him. He built a fire and warmed himself by drinking hot water. Then he built a camp on the rocks as he had done the night before. The last things he did were to be certain that his matches were dry and to wind his watch. The blankets were wet. His ankle pained him, but he knew only that he was hungry. Through his restless sleep, he dreamed of feasts and food served in all imaginable manners. When he awakened, he was cold and sick. There was no sun. The gray of the earth and sky had become deeper. A cold wind was blowing and snow was whitening the hilltops. The air about him grew white with snow as he made a fire and boiled more water. But it was wet snow, half rain. At first it melted as soon as it hit the earth, but it continued falling, covering the ground and destroying his fire. This was the signal for him to put his pack on his back and struggle forward. He knew not where. He was not concerned with the land of the little sticks, nor with Bill and the cache under the upturned boat by the River Dease. He was mad because of hunger. He did not notice the course he followed, except that it led him through the bottoms of the valleys. He felt his way through the wet snow to the watery muskeg berries, and was guided by touch as he pulled up the grass by the roots. But it had no taste, and did not satisfy his hunger. He had no fire that night, nor hot water. He pulled his blanket around him to sleep the broken sleep of hunger. The snow became a cold rain. He awakened many times to feel it falling on his upturned face. Day came. It was a gray day with no sun. It had ceased raining. The sharpness of his hunger had departed. There was a dull pain in his stomach, but it did not trouble him so much. He was more in control of himself, and once again he was interested in the land of little sticks and the cache by the River Dease. He cut the remains of one of his blankets into strips and bound his bleeding feet. He used one of the strips on his swelled ankle and prepared himself for a day of travel. When he was ready to pick up his pack, he paused long before deciding to keep the moose skin bag. But when he departed, it went with him. The snow had melted under the rain, and only the hilltops showed white. The sun appeared, and he succeeded in locating the way he had been traveling. But now he knew that he was lost. Perhaps he had wandered too far to the left. He now turned to the right to return to his true course. Although the hunger pains were not as great as they had been, he realized that he was weak. He was forced to pause for frequent rests. At those times, he ate the muskeg berries and grasses. His tongue felt dry and large, and it tasted bitter in his mouth. His heart troubled him very much. When he had traveled a few minutes, it would begin pounding. Then it would leap in a series of beats that made him feel faint. In the middle of the day, he found two small fish in a large pool. It was impossible to empty it. But he was calmer now, and he managed to catch them. They were no bigger than his little finger, but now he was not particularly hungry. The dull pain in his stomach had been growing duller. It almost seemed that his stomach was asleep. He ate the fish with great care. The eating was an act of pure reason. Although he had no desire to eat, he knew that he must eat to live. In the evening, he caught three more small fish, eating two and saving the third for breakfast. The sun had dried the wet plants, and he was able to build a fire. He had not traveled more than 10 miles that day. The next day, traveling whenever his heart permitted, he went no more than 5 miles. But his stomach did not give him any pain. It seemed to be sleeping. He was now in a strange country, too, and the caribou were becoming more plentiful. There were wolves also. Their howls could be heard across the land, and once he saw three of them crossing his path. Another night passed, and in the morning, being more reasonable, he untied the leather string that held the moose-skin bag. From its open mouth poured a yellow stream of gold dust. He divided the gold into two equal parts. One half, wrapped in a piece of a blanket, he hid among a large formation of rocks. The other half he returned to his bag. He also began to use strips of the one remaining blanket for his feet. He still kept his gun, because there were cartridges in that cache by the River Dease. This was a cloudy day, and this day hunger waked in him again. He was very weak. It was no uncommon thing now for him to fall. Once he fell into a bird's nest. There were four tiny birds, a day or so old, no more than a mouthful. He ate them greedily, putting them alive into his mouth and crushing them like eggshells between his teeth. The mother bird flew about him with cries of anger. He used his gun as a club with which to hit her, but she flew beyond his reach. He threw stones at her and by chance broke a wing. She then ran away, dragging the broken wing, with him following her. The little birds had not satisfied his hunger. He jumped along on his painful ankle, throwing stones and screaming loudly at times. At other times he struggled along silently, picking himself up patiently when he fell, or rubbing his eyes with his hand when faintness threatened to overpower him. The bird led him across some wet ground in the bottom of the valley. He discovered footprints in the wet grasses. They were not his own, he could see that. They must be Bill's. But he could not stop because the mother bird was running ahead. He would catch her first, then he would return and examine the footprints. He tired the mother bird, but he tired himself also. She lay on her side, breathing heavily. He lay on his side a dozen feet away, unable to move toward her. And as he recovered, she recovered. She flew beyond reach as his hungry hand stretched out to catch her. The hunt started again. Night darkened, and she escaped. He fell because of weakness, cutting his face. He did not move for a long time. Then he rolled on his side. He wound his watch and lay there until morning. It was another gray day. Half of his last blanket had been used for foot wrappings. He failed to find Bill's trail again. It was not important. His hunger drove him on. He wondered if Bill, too, were lost. By the middle of the day, the weight of his pack became too great. Again, he divided the gold, this time merely pouring half of it on the ground. In the afternoon, he threw away the rest of it. There remained now only the half of the blanket, the tin container, and the gun. A hallucination began to trouble him. He felt certain that one cartridge remained. It was in his gun, and he had not seen it. However, he knew all the time that the gun was empty. But the hallucination continued. He fought it for hours. Then he opened his gun eagerly, only to find nothing inside. He struggled ahead for half an hour when the hallucination arose again. Again he fought it, and still it continued. To give himself relief, he again opened the gun and found it empty. At times his mind wandered even further, but these moments away from reality were brief, because always the pains of hunger forced him to return. Once, as his mind was wandering, he was returned to reality by a sight that almost caused him to faint. Before him stood a horse. A horse! He could not believe his eyes. A thick cloud was in his eyes, flashing with points of light. He rubbed his eyes fiercely to clear his sight. Then he saw before him not a horse, but a great brown bear. The animal was studying him with curiosity.
And that's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.